Okay, so with me is Michael Hogan. Now, the name will probably be familiar to you if you do Strictly Come Dancing, because I do believe that you run a blog on Strictly Come Dancing, don't you, Michael?
I do, on the Guardian website.
I am indeed. I don't watch it, so I don't follow your blog because I'd be lost. But what I'm going to tell people is that Michael used to be a neighbour of mine. We lived at the top of my road in Felixstowe many, many, many moons ago. So I think we were possibly 8, 9, 10 before you moved away.
Yeah.
And when I say moved away, you moved to Recreation Close, didn't you?
About half a mile down the road, so not too far away.
Yeah, but when you're 10 years old, it is like you're moving away forever, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So we grew up together-ish. I remember playing football on the grass by your houses, and we'd play World Cup singles. Me, you, and Patrick.
You're a goalkeeper.
I was probably the wrong shape to run around the pitch, Michael.
But the right shape to sort of stop shots, maybe.
Yes, and we had one or two others. I think the Lawrence brothers may occasionally dipped in and out, but we had a few games of football on there. And like I say, we were in the same year at school, so even though we didn't go through school as really close friends, our paths crossed, didn't they? We were never enemies. We were never close buddies, but we were in between, weren't we? Well, not even in between. We were closer to friends than anything else, weren't we, really?
I think so. I'd like to think so.
Yes. And then we will get to your book, but I'm just trying to build a little picture up. You moved away. Was it university? You went to university?
Yeah, I went to university in Durham, aged 18, University of Durham, and did English, and then moved to London to study journalism. And
you've been in London ever since?
Yeah, yeah.
I popped your name into Google, and now there's another author called Michael Hogan, isn't there? An American chap.
There's a guy, a guy who writes for Vanity Fair in America.
Yes, that's the one. But
sometimes get confused with, and I often don't correct people.
Google told me that you're living in Mexico at the moment.
Oh, am I?
Yes. So
that's nice to know.
It gave you a bio, exactly what you've been up to, et cetera, and said you now live in Mexico.
There you go. You can't believe everything you read on the internet.
No, so AI is not going to take all our jobs, is it? So because we was in the same year at school and you moved away, you sort of in the public eye-ish, weren't you? So I've sort of followed you from afar, and you know, like it is when you know people and you get a little bit proud. So when I see your name, even when you pop Channel 5 on and there's one of these list programs and there's you, one of the talking heads, I'm like,
yeah,
I went to school with him. You'd gone past and it was Phil Jupiter. And she went, you went to school with Phil Jupiter? No, Michael Hogan. So I had to rewind it and show her. And so, there's a little bit of proudness that people from Felixstowe have left and gone on to do good things.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So, anyway, I do rabbit on a bit. So you probably noticed that.
It's your job, Jamie.
Yeah, well, it's not. It's my hobby.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's all my hobby, but I really love it. It's something that I wish I'd have done years ago rather than just the last three.
Yeah, I feel a bit that way about writing books.
I was going to get to that. You're a writer, and it's really hard to believe that at 55, I'm going to tell your age because people know who I am, so I said you're in my year at school, so I'm not giving any secrets away. It's your first book.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did it take you so long?
I don't know, really. I think, you know, partly I had a sort of proper job for a long time. I was a journalist and I used to edit magazines and then I guess I hit 50 and, you know, lockdown happened and things like that, and you kind of think, oh, I better get on with stuff. And I've always wanted to write a book, but I slightly regret it took me quite so long, but I'm glad I did eventually.
Now, I haven't read it yet, but the sole reason is because I had a local author, Ian Maitland, on my show last year, I think, and I actually was talking about his books and I just finished it and I gave away the ending. Which isn't the done thing.
How did he feel about that?
He was like, you could see the shock on his face. And I was like, yeah, so I thought, right, I've got it. I'm going to read it, but I want to speak to you first so we can talk about the book, etc. But I don't know about the story, so I can't give it away.
Okay, be wise.
And you can't hate me. So I keep looking. My head keeps, because I'm doing this over Zoom, people. So because Michael lives in London, so, and we're doing this over Zoom so I can play it back on the show. And I'm we got the video, and I'm looking. My head keeps tilting at reading some of the books you've got on your shelf there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in my little kind of they call it my book nook.
Your book nook.
Yeah. When I want to escape from the family and have a private conversation on Zoom like this.
Yes, like this indeed.
I retire here. I normally write actually in a shed at the bottom of my garden, but the Wi-Fi is not that good down there, so which is handy when you're trying to concentrate on writing a book, but less handy when you're doing a Zoom call.
Yes, because if you're if you've got the temptation of just I'll just take a couple of minutes off, and you go down rabbit holes, and then
absolutely
2 hours that you put aside to do something you've only done for 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's really easy. I mean, some people use kind of blocking software or you know, or turn off their social media and stuff for a few hours, but I find that just having wonky Wi-Fi is enough for me.
Yes, because what you do, you're sort of semi-reliant on social media a lot, aren't you, to get out what you do.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, social media's been a sort of a boon for journalism, really, in some ways. It's not only, you not only can find stories and people on there, but you can sort of publicise your work. I've made a lot of friends on social media, made a lot of contacts on there.
Yes. So I do,
and obviously it's quite crucial when it comes to publicising a book. So, it's kind of a necessary evil, I'd say.
I totally understand that, because it's not what it was. It's turned a bit dark in places, but if you only use it for what you're using it for, then you can avoid that nastiness, I think.
Yeah, you're getting arguments about certain subjects with people,
yeah.
So try not to express opinions.
Yes, so I suppose it's harder for you to. I found that out because I used to have opinions. I've still got opinions on everything, but because of what I do with radio, I'm sort of governed by Ofcom as well. So I can't get into the spats and put people right. In my opinion, I can't no longer do that on social media so much because Ofcom.
Yeah.
Which is, I suppose, with you, you're working in the public eye, doing your bits here, there, and everywhere. If you're saying you don't want to go down that thing of being pigeonholed into something that you're actually not, just because you've got an opinion on something, so just play it cool down the middle, and I think we're safe, aren't we?
Yeah, I write for a lot for the Telegraph and also for the Guardian, which obviously politically are quite
far apart.
But I tend to write about sort of pop culture and TV, especially, which does tend to be apolitical, despite. But
yes, I think
people can still make it apolitical when they want.
Exactly. If you lean left or you lean right, you're still going to watch Strictly Come Dancing, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah, which is pictures in my head that shouldn't be. Anyway, so your book. Now, it's ingenious, really, because who finds dead bodies? Every time you open, it's dog walkers, isn't it?
So that's absolutely.
I'm not giving anything away because, one, I haven't read the book, but it's called Dog Walkers Detective Agency. So I think that's... So tell me a little bit about this book, Michael.
Well, it's about... Yeah, it's kind of a cozy crime mystery for people who like dogs and whodunits, and or possibly both, or possibly neither. So it's about this group of dog walkers who find a dead body in the woods. And yeah, you're absolutely right, Jamie, when you say that they often do. And then I looked into this because I was out. I'll tell you what happened. I was out walking with my dog, and we found a comatose man in the bushes.
Ooh.
And luckily he was drunk and breathing and just sleeping something off. But it got me thinking as my mind wandered on the dog walk. What if he'd been dead? What would have happened then? And so I kind of did some research, and it turns out that 40% of what's called unexpected dead bodies, which means people who didn't die at home or in hospital or normal circumstances, 40% of them are found by dog walk.
Really, that much?
Yeah, which is why you always hear on the news, that a corpse was found by a couple out walking their spaniel on the heath or whatever. Yeah. Happens all the time. I guess because dog walkers go to remote places
and dogs have
sensitive noses, and there's all sorts of reasons. Joggers find quite a lot of dead bodies too. But I use that as sort of jumping off point for a murder mystery, really. I kind of thought, what would happen if a dog walker found a dead body and then decided, along with his dog walking mates, to investigate the crime himself?
Superbs. Now, I've got the Penguin. Imagine getting your first book published by Penguin. That's something, isn't it?
It's a bit of a dream come true, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, but it's such an iconic sort of publisher, and we can all picture the spines of the books with little aquatic birds on them, and so it's a bit of a dream come true that Penguin wanted to.
Now, I'm having a little bit of a flashback to Causton, and I do remember there wasn't many readers, but me, you, and Mark Griffith were readers.
Yeah.
It was a quiet corner, we could go and sit and read, and often us three would be in there, that's in primary school.
Absolutely. Well, I think people who like to read tend to get the bug early, one can start. Everyone remembers how they started on things like, I don't know. We were probably reading things like Stig of the Dump, I imagine.
Well, I remember Mark was reading the Mr. Men books at an early age. He was big on the Mr. Men books. And hopefully he'll listen back to this and he'll message me and say, I've got it all wrong. It wasn't him, but it definitely was. It definitely was. Now, on there, it says the sleepy coastal town of Framston.
Yeah. Does that ring any bells?
Yes. Sleepy coastal town of Framston. That, and I looked at that and I thought, yeah, he hasn't left Felixstowe at all, really. Am I right there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of, you know, I live in London, and so the sort of obvious temptation was to set the book here. But then I kind of thought, no, let's not do that because, you know, most people don't live in London. Most people don't even live in city.
Yes.
And so, you know, a murder mystery is a very different thing outside of a city, I think, even down to practical things like phone reception and the way a crime can impact a community. It would be just a drop in the ocean in London if someone got killed.
If it's in, let's say, London, Camden, whoever, it's an everyday occurrence.
Absolutely. And even things like, you know, in outside cities, it's sort of darker at night and, you know, the weather has more of an impact. And so there's all sorts of reasons why I thought, let's move it out of London. And then, because I grew up in Felixstowe, it seemed obvious to set it somewhere like that, but kind of lightly fictionalised, hence Framston.
Yes. So when I read this and it's set in this sleep, because is there anything in the book that I can actually think that's Felixstowe or is it?
Yeah, I think so.
Ed.
There's no. Some of the locations are set on, are based on places that I know in London or in Somerset.
I spent
a lot in Somerset where my in-laws live. But most of it is inspired by Felixstowe, I would say, particularly the woods. A lot of it happens in the woods with dog walking, which is kind of based on places like, is it called The Grove?
Yes, The Grove. Yes. Yeah.
My memory is sort of fuzzy. I've not lived there for 30 years. But and then there's a recreation ground called Framston Rec, which is loosely based on Felixstowe Rec.
Excellent.
And just that sort of, I think there's something really atmospheric about seaside towns, particularly ones that maybe were resorts, you know, 100 years ago, or that have sort of maybe slightly faded a bit, and then maybe enjoying a resurgence. And I think Felixstowe is a bit like that.
That's it. They're all moving on and becoming more 21st century, but there's still elements of them that are the Victorian age.
I think that's really evocative. You know, it's like, you know, that you get that sort of old seaside resort kind of trimmings with a kind of a modern town, and maybe a town that's being slightly gentrified in certain corners, but remaining quite, as you say, resolutely old-fashioned in others. And I think everyone knows somewhere a bit like that. You might have holidayed there, or you might live there, or visit there. And so, yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, I can sort of picture Framston in my head. And it's kind of 80% Felix.
Oh, fantastic. I love that. Now, I mentioned his name earlier, Ian Maitland, and there's another local author, Jeanette Hewitt, who I know. And there's another lady I've just been getting in contact with, Julie Misson, and they write books, and they base them in and around, or some of them, they base in and around Felixstowe. So I was reading one of Ian's books, and he was talking about walking into town and going into the Tesco in town opposite the... And I'm like, oh my God, I've just done that. And you think, yeah. And it is. I just get a little bit of a buzz of excitement when I can see or read about Felixstowe. I know it may come across a little bit soppy, but no, I love it.
Absolutely. And well, I think a lot of people like that. Like, you know, often when you go on holiday somewhere, you might read a book that's set there. You know, I think there's something kind of immersive about reading somewhere where you are, whether it's where you live or whether you're going on holiday somewhere. I think that's really fascinating. The way people describe things kind of brings them to life, and you might agree with it or you might like not, but if you feel like you know it already, I think that adds an extra dimension to the reading experience.
It does indeed.
And even like things like, I don't know, there was a bit in the book, it's just one line that doesn't really mean much in terms of the plot, but there's a bit about when you almost forget sometimes that you're in a seaside town, I think, in Felixstowe.
Yes.
And then you might crest over a hill or look down a street and suddenly you can see the sea again. And it's sort of shimmering away in the distance. And just little things like that, I think, really stuck with me. Just those sort of memories that haven't really left me after 30 years. And in the pubs as well. There's quite a lot of it is set in pubs. I don't think it's giving anything away to say that the murder victim who's found by the dog walkers is a local pub landlord. So, and that's kind of a way into discussing kind of pubs. There's there's some old man's pubs. There's some kind of more young people's pubs. There's pubs that are kind of...
It's still the same.
Yeah. Ones that are a bit kind of, you know, gentrified or gastro pub.
The unfortunate thing, Michael, is I'm now in the old man pubs.
Well, no one wants to be the old man at the disco, do they?
No.
But there is a character in the book who is sort of a middle-aged man who is often in the sort of young person's pub, and that becomes a bit of a plot point as to why that is.
Excellent. I'm as soon as we're done this, but when I finish my book I'm currently reading, yours will be next on the go, because as I said, I didn't want to spoil anything. But is it a one and done, or is there more?
Hopefully there's more. Yeah, I'm kind of waiting for the green light, but I've got at least one, if not two more, planned out in my head and somewhere on paper. And so, yeah, I'm hoping it becomes a series, because it's, you know, there's always dogs to be walked and crimes to be solved.
There is indeed. And it's they're very popular at the moment, aren't they, Cozy? Even though it's not a new thing. Everyone thinks that a certain TV host invented the genre, but he didn't. It's been going for a long, long time. I think he just made it popular again. And it's great, because now I do love the macabre. I read a lot of psychological thrillers and gore and blood and guts and stuff. But you know what? I still love a cozy.
I think you're right.
Because of the humour in them.
Yeah, and the character thing. And you know, I mean, my love of crime goes back to sort of Agatha Christie and that sort of golden age of detective stories, and Sherlock Holmes before that.
Well, Agatha Christie, she was the first cozy crime novel, probably.
I mean, and it's got a sort of a slight misnomer. Some people bristle at the description cozy crime.
Yeah.
But her, she was very good at the dark side of human nature, but kind of normally in a country manor house or in a little village investigated by an old lady or Belgian man. With a nice moustache, you know.
Middle to upper class, wasn't it, really? It wasn't the
working.
Didn't sort of dip too much into the working class, did she, Agatha?
But there was a kind of below stairs element, I guess, a bit sort of down to Levis.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. But I think sort of a bit of humour and a bit... I think the great thing about cozy crime, so-called cozy crime, is that it's very accessible. You don't need to have a high tolerance for gore or psychological darkness. Really. There's normally a murder, because there sort of has to be, but it often happens kind of off camera, and isn't described terribly graphically, and you don't really follow the killer. It's more of a kind of whodunit puzzle, which everyone loves to solve. There's something about human nature that we want to solve puzzles and kind of put the world back in order.
So the murder becomes a sub-element of the book, really, doesn't it? And it's more about the people. I always say The Walking Dead is not really about zombies. It's about people, with the zombies being the sub-theme.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and it's probably, you know, a metaphor for all sorts of things as well, isn't it? But often things that are consigned to genres are actually just stories.
Yes. Yeah, and... again, if we all label, it doesn't matter what label you got on it. If it's good, it's good. I say that with music as well. When people say, there's certain genres I love, but it doesn't stop me dipping my toe into other genres as well.
I think things get pigeonholed too quickly. And if you talk, you know, look at Richard Osman's books, which you alluded to earlier, I think they're hugely pop, not hindered by the fact that he's quite famous and on telly all the time, but they're really well written and they're really funny and they're about really vivid characters. You kind of know those four characters within about the first 50 pages.
Yeah. And then the Marlowe Murder Club came out, even though apparently it was written before. And I love them as well.
Yeah, and you know, and Reverend Richard Coles is doing very well with his...
I haven't read his yet, but they're meant to be quite good.
Yeah, there's a TV adaptation on at the moment, actually, called Murder Before Evensong. And it's very much in that sort of golden age crime tradition, and sort of like one of those ones, if you remember, you and I were growing up, you'd hear these kind of names on TV because there'd be TV adaptations like P.D. James and Ruth Rendell and people like that. Similar stories to that, you know, sort of small towns, a dark thing happens, family secrets unravel. And that's just a universal story, I think, really.
And it all ends up being part of the human psyche, doesn't it? As you say, unraveling the human psyche and how people tick and how they all link in, and a man you might notice in the corner, he's got something to do with it, and all things like that. Yeah, it's all...
Yeah, and I sort of, you know, I watch a lot of TV as my job. I'm a sort of TV critic a lot of the time. And there is a lot of quite dark crime. And there's also a bit of a trope, both on TV and film, for kind of murdered, mutilated women, often found naked.
Yes.
It gets a bit fetishized, and that's become a bit of a cliche. And I certainly wanted to avoid that. But there's something about cozy crime. It, on TV, you know, I loved all those shows like Jonathan Creek or Columbo, or, you know, even things like Bergerac and Lovejoy and those kind of Sunday night crime dramas.
Have you watched the reboot of Bergerac yet?
I have, yes.
Yes, did you enjoy it?
I did quite enjoy it. It was better than I thought it was going to be.
Yes, me too. I thought this could be rubbish, and it wasn't. It was done quite well, actually.
Yeah, I think so. And again, Jersey's just a very evocative setting, isn't it? It's kind of, you know, it's like a tax haven version of Felix.
Now, you said that you do or you have done TV critic. Do you still do much TV critic work?
Yeah, I've been writing some only today, actually, and I've just reviewed there's a new knitting contest hosted by Tom Daly.
I saw that flash up on social media, and I thought, brilliant. It's just because there was a picture of him at the Olympics or something knitting in between rounds, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, he kind of jumped on it.
Brilliant.
His coach told him to find a hobby because he was too intense in competition and kind of, you know, get himself all kind of wound up and over anxious. He needed something to sort of relax him between dives, because a lot of waiting around when you're an Olympic diver. And somehow he took up knitting and has become this kind of poster boy for the new generation of knitting. And now he's got this kind of great British Bake Off style knitting contest on Channel 4. It starts on Sunday night. I've been reviewing that today.
So can you watch TV and just enjoy it without thinking about it too much?
Yeah, I can actually. Yeah, I love to watch stuff with my family. And sorry, my dog's barking in the background. I don't know if you can hear that. But it's just adding atmosphere for the Dog Walks Detective Agency.
Yeah, brilliant.
I can sort of switch on and off, really. There's a difference, I think, between watching TV in the evening with your family and maybe a glass of wine than there is during the day at a desk with a pair of headphones on. And I find that quite easy to switch between those two modes. More of a problem is drawing a line between my journalism work and my fiction writing work. That's a slightly more muddy line, but I managed to do that as well by sort of dividing my day in half, kind of literally.
So you've got it planned meticulously, have you?
I think to write a novel, you've got to get your bum in the seat. I think a lot of people say, you know, you've got to carve out the writing time, otherwise it'll never happen. You know how many people want to write a novel, including me for many years.
Including me, yeah.
There we are.
Yeah, but I sometimes think that my thoughts in my head need just to stay there.
Well, possibly, but you know, it might be helpful to get them down on paper. Whether you then show them to people is up to you. But
yes, now I'm just going to bring up, I think we may have mentioned this on Twitter several years ago, but I need to bring it out into the open. You told me a lie once, which I believed. And it was that you were one of the first families in Felixstowe that I knew of to have teletext television.
Yes.
And you told me that when the opening shot of Coronation Street, it actually came up meow next to the cat on the roof.
That was wish fulfillment rather than...
And then I was telling my nana about it and stuff like that. And then my uncle, who had teletext, said, why are you lying to your nana? Yeah, thanks. So you got me to trouble off my nana there.
I'm so sorry. I can only retrospectively apologise many years later.
Lots of water under the bridge there. So I think we're nearly done, Michael. I look forward to the book. I want to thank you for your time for this interview. And it will go, well, I say it will go out. It's Saturday, 1st of November. So those listening, I recorded this on Thursday. And hopefully we'll do it again when book two comes out.
I'd love to, yeah. This has been really, really good fun, Jamie. I've enjoyed the little reminisce. I mean, Ipswich Town FC yet?
Adam?
Haven't talked about Ipswich Town FC?
Oh, no, we haven't. Do you go and see them at all?
Yeah. I go to a few games a season, home and away, when they play in London, and, you know, occasional trip down to Portman Road and follow them every Saturday with mixed feelings.
It's hard work, isn't it?
It's been hard work on and off for the last 50 years. But there's been lots of high points.
Yeah, so I will say that my teams in life are Ipswich Town, Heart of Midlothian, Kent Cricket Club, and England football team. So no one can ever, ever, ever accuse me of being a glory hunter.
Absolutely. How did you chance upon Hearts and Kent?
Well, Kent was Venture Week at school. Do you remember we used to have...
Yeah.
I'd done cricket in the first year, and then we went with Essex versus Kent in the Gillette Cup.
I think I was there too, but I supported Essex.
Yes, and there was a lad... I did mention him earlier, one of the Lawrence brothers, Lee Lawrence, he was sitting on his own, and I said, Lee, I said, what are you doing on your own? He said, I support Kent. I said, well, I'll come and sit with you then. So that's how I became a Kent fan.
Oh, that's a lovely to support Kent, isn't it?
And the Hearts story is a little bit darker.
Oh.
Not too dark, though. My paternal grandparent, my nana, was from Edinburgh, family all from Edinburgh, so I've got family up there, and they were all Hibs fans.
Right.
So when I went up Edinburgh when I was 12 or 13, one of me in-law uncles took me to Hibs 1 week, Hibs St Mirren, and Frank McAvenny scored for St Mirren, they won 1-0. That's what I remember about that game.
Yeah.
And
probably had a mullet and very tight shorts.
Possibly did. And the second game was Hearts, and he said, right, which one did you prefer? I said, Hearts. He said, you do know this is going to crucify your family up here. And I said, I'm Hearts. And some of them still don't speak to me.
So it's slightly, you were being slightly contrary by supporting Hearts.
I'd say. So I went for the choice because I know it would annoy people. And that's the sort of bloke I was. And some people say I'm still like that, Michael. Oh, dear.
Well, my second team, I think, would probably be Newcastle or Arsenal. Partly because I live near Arsenal and I went to college near.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? So logistically, you're not doing anything. Now, I've got a nephew, my brother Rory's boy. He wasn't in the football because Rory was not. You remember Rory, my little brother Rory?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So...
Say hi from me.
Will do. So his son was never really into football because Rory wasn't, but he got into playing on computer. He said, my team's Arsenal. I said, why? He said, because they're the best on FIFA.
The modern world for you.
Yeah, so I've heard, you know...
We didn't have that problem.
Your dad's team or your local team, or because they're winning all the time, but now Arsenal because they're the best on FIFA. So, yeah.
Where's the romance in that?
But he now lives in Scotland. He's married a Scottish girl and I've got two children and he's a regular rugby goer. He's into his rugby now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sport I never really got into. Just cricket is my ultimate sport and a bit of football.
Yeah, I'm a big cricket fan still. I go to test matches quite a lot and the occasional county game, often in Somerset, actually, at Taunton County Ground.
Yeah, you say you and Laws are down now, don't
they? Yeah, yeah.
Taunton, which again, ground.
Yeah, it's beautiful and it's, you know, and it's quite a lively cider-fueled crowd down there. It's got the... I heard that it's got the highest rate of ground ejections for drunk and disorderly of any cricket ground in England.
Really? You'd have thought, yeah. Oh, yeah, but then again, I've been to Glastonbury on that scrumpy jack, so I can imagine. Yeah. Yeah. Does tend to make you lose your mind a little bit.
Yeah, and they tend to start early as well. And, you know, and so at the end of a long day's cricket, it can get a bit...
tetchy.
Yeah.
Right, I've got the thing up to say we're going to end shortly, so I am going to say thank you for your time, Michael. Best of luck with the book. Hope you sell loads and loads and loads of copies, and who knows, one day they'll turn it into a Channel 5 series and we can film it in Felixstowe.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
You could be an extra.
I could.
Or maybe, you know, maybe in a larger role, Jamie. I don't want to, you know, limit you to being an extra.
Do you know what? Just have my face on TV in something good that's not Crime Watch would do me the world of good, mate. Brilliant. Thanks for your time, Michael, and I'll share the link to you for the program.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for having me.
Yep. Cheers for your time. Lovely.